The Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. We're joined Mondays. We're joined by Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. You'll find her stuff at thinkglink.com. Okay, how are you today, Elise?
Oh, John, you know, just sitting here watching the news go by.
That was a busy weekend for that. Did you have a particular angle? Like, I was thinking, okay, you do real estate and homes. That means lumber. That means Canada. I don't know. Talk to me about the trade implications and what you noticed.
Well, it's interesting. So we've seen over the weekend, February 1st came and went, and we saw President Trump institute or say that he was instituting pretty significant tariffs on Canada and on Mexico and on China. And what I was thinking about, John, is how much of our homes that we build and furnish and renovate use ingredients from all of these different countries. And I think people don't really realize what the percentage of imports are that are used in residential construction. So, for example, in 2023, and I put this on my Substack today, Love Money in Real Estate, China represents 27% of the imports that are used when you're building a new home, for example. And a lot of that is things like wallboard or it's electronics. Mexico is 11%. Canada is 8%. Vietnam, Taiwan, Germany, Japan, India, those are all around 4-4.5%. And then there's Thailand and South Korea. And then about a quarter are sort of all the other countries put together. And when you look at kind of these building products, I think, you know, people just do not understand, right? Like lumber, $8.5 billion of lumber comes from Canada. They've got a lot of forests up there, the ones that haven't burned down yet. And in fact, that's 70% of the lumber that we use to frame houses and apartment buildings comes from Canada. And so if you're using that as a builder and you're trying to keep track of your costs on a spreadsheet on a computer that's made in China, and then you fill your household that you're selling with appliances that you put together in Mexico, that's going to be some pretty pricey stuff if these tariffs really take effect.
Yeah. And so you wonder, will they really take effect? And if so, for how long? We've already bought a month just from the scare tactic from Mexico. Colombia is now taking migrants that are being uploaded onto airplanes. And maybe Canada and the U.S. will come to some sort of accommodation. I hope so anyway.
Well, I hope so, too. I mean, in Canada, they're fighting back, right? They've already said, fine, you do that. We're going to do this, this, and this. And one of the things that they've done is sort of interesting because I believe that they canceled their Starlink deal, which Starlink, of course, I believe is Elon Musk.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, so, you know, they know where they're to poke the bear and the bear's assistant as it is. And so we'll see what happens.
That's
there.
That's an interesting point because it's been widely reported that many of the things that they're targeting are products or materials that come out of red states. They want to get the attention of the Republicans who obviously, you know, make the decisions in the Congress now. So it's Kentucky bourbon. It's, I've got the list here, but if you just think about what are the things that come from typically red states, those are the very products that Trudeau has said they will put tariffs on.
Yeah, and I think they're not kidding around here, right? I mean, Mexico is, you know, the new president there, is looking at, you know, sending 10,000 of Mexican troops to the border to strengthen the border. Probably not a bad idea anyway for them to protect their side of the border. But, you know, what else is going to come down the pike? What you don't want to do is clog things up and close the border so that trucks carrying your, you know, your washing machines and your dishwashers and you know, car parts go back and forth, by the way, a couple of times over that border. You don't want that clogging things up. And it'll be interesting to see how they can make that work.
There's a story in the New York Times yesterday, and it mentioned a manufacturer in the Chicago area, fourth generation firm. They do metalworking, and they are happy to have these tariffs. I talked to the owner of the company off the air today, and I think we'll hear from this person tomorrow. But I think we'll hear from the flip side of this as well. But this guy was very pro-tariffs. He said it's good. It will mean fewer goods coming in, and that will be good for American workers and wages. It won't be inflationary. I'm not an economist, but I've heard from some economists who said the exact opposite. But he also thought it would be good to help protect his industry. Well, of course he would. But what about other industries? What about farmers who now know that their products that are heading out will be hit with tariffs on the way out the door? And if you can buy maybe grain or corn from Brazil instead of Illinois, you probably will, right?
Well, I'm more concerned about the oranges, the avocados, tomatoes, lettuce, and beans that are now ripening in fields across the country that aren't actually going to get picked. You know, they're literally are not. I know it seems like we have lots of people who are able-bodied and just sitting around playing, you know, video games all day long. But the reality is that we're at near low historic employment. Most people, almost everybody who can work is working, maybe sometimes two jobs. And I don't think there are a lot of extra hands just sort of lying around waiting for a, you know, $15 an hour job to pick, you know, corn and peas. So we'll see how that actually plays out, because a lot of that stuff is also grown in red states.
I'll just hold out that maybe it won't be as bad as we have been told, at least by economists and Democrats. But people who don't seem to have skin in the game but just know a little bit about the math of the thing are telling us this is dangerous. Other people will say the opposite. So I don't know, and I guess we'll have to wait and see. I would hope that we can cut costs. I would hope that we can be more efficient. I would hope that we can do things to protect American jobs and increase wages without all of us paying more at the store. This person I was talking to today said, yeah, well, who needs more cheap shoes from China? And I thought, everybody that goes to Walmart, I mean, people actually want inexpensive goods. And if the goods are made in America and are more expensive, I'm not sure that they're going to say, hooray, we're employing Americans, when the shoe, instead of costing $29, costs $39.
Or $139.
Talking to Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Talk to me about the costs of owning a home, Elise.
Well, you know, Clever Real Estate, which does a lot of data online about the real estate industry, did a survey and broke down what typical annual home expenses look like. And just as a homeowner myself, I can tell you, I thought this looked pretty good. The typical American will spend $24,500 on home expenses in addition to their mortgage, right? So it's pretty expensive. Utilities, $7,300. Maintenance repairs, a little over $6,000. About $5,700 on home renovations. $3,000 on taxes, because the typical person doesn't live in Chicago, I think. Homeowners insurance, $2,300. And for those who are part of a homeowners association, whether it's a condo or it's a gated community, there's an extra expense of about $3,000, maybe $3,100 a year. And that would bring their costs up a little bit. And of course, 81% of Americans think that the costs of homeownership are higher than anticipated. And I'm going to guess that that's because they just don't understand all these different things that pop up. Maybe not every year. Some do, though.
Yeah.
And they cost a lot of money.
You know, you said the number looked right to you. And when I saw this, you sent it to Pete and he shared it with me. I thought it looked high. And maybe because of the renovations. But you're right. Some years you aren't going to spend $5,700. But if you do get the bathroom redone, you're going to spend more than $20,000. So that would be a few years worth of maybe renovations prorated out to $5,700 a year. Utilities, $7,300 a year. That means about $600 a month. Does that sound right? Gas, electric, and water, $600 a month?
Could be a little bit high, especially, I mean, if you're in a condo building where heat is provided, that's, you know, you're paying electrical, but maybe it's way high for what you pay. But I'm guessing that for a lot of people, once you add in all of the utilities, garbage removal, for example, I think you might get close to that.
The property taxes, I think, are low. If you're paying less than $3,000 a year in property taxes, be thankful. Don't move. I mean,
because, right. As I said, they're not living here in Chicago.
Well, and or in the suburbs, because if you look at some of the suburbs and some of the nicer ones, of course, but even some of the you know, just average ones, I think people are paying more than $3,000. You know, Brendan and I have that house in Ottawa. It's a lot more than $3,000. The industrial base in some of these smaller towns is eroded. And so the property taxes go up to make up for the schools and the other expenses. $3,000 sounds like a deal to me.
Yeah, it sounded low to me as well, and I'm not quite sure, you know, what they're basing that on. Also, home prices are now, you know, $400,000 is kind of your average sales price. Again, we're a little bit below that in Chicago. A lot of places are above that, and if you're paying $3,000, that's less than 1%, which is less than, you know, California Prop, whatever that was, that passed, that held property taxes to 1%. So they're probably a little bit low there, but then again, a little bit high on some of the other things. The other thing I think they're a little bit low on going forward is homeowners insurance at $2,300. If you look at what people on the coast are paying, it's far above that. If you're looking what people are paying sort of in South Dakota, it's probably below. So, yeah. You know, again, averages are sort of hard to understand.
Well, and I suppose if you're whatever your insurance bill was last year, I think the next 12 months as various policies renew for people, it'll be interesting to see what they say. You're in Illinois, you didn't get a hurricane or fire, but guess what? You're a State Farm customer, and they're going to maybe prorate it across the country. I wonder if everybody's insurance rates are going to go up this year.
They are. I think in Illinois, it's already been approved from one of the insurers that they can go up about 14%. I would say you're absolutely right. I think we are going to all, and I, by all, I mean not just metro area, I mean across the country, we're going to pay for things like that California fire and the last hurricanes that came across the Gulf. But by the same token, here in Chicago, you know, we've got a lot of flooding that happens now. We get these massive rainstorms, and you end up with the Des Plaines River flooding. People, we end up paying for that as well. And so I think everywhere, you know, there's a cost to climate change, no matter who's causing it or how it happened. There's a cost to that, and we all pick that up.
So maybe we should not be thankful, but maybe not be so resentful that the fires out west might increase your rates, because that's insurance. It's a shared cost, and when it's your turn, the money will be there, right?
Well, we hope so. I think people are resentful because I think there are some things that could be done that would help prevent it, the cost from going up. Like, for example, you know, should we really be rebuilding on the Gulf Coast or around the, you know, the coast of Florida, where we know there are going to be hurricanes, we know they're going to be worse and worse as they go forward, cause more and more damage? Should we rebuild on there, yeah, or should we not? And I think that those are the kinds of questions that people way smarter than me, you know, I'm good with how much it's going to cost to rebuild. I'm good with the total amount of disasters and what they cost us. I can't predict the future of policy that way.
How many new homes were built last year?
You know, we built a little over 1 million new homes, John, but the problem is we really need to build 1.3 million, according to the National Association of Home Builders, just to stay even with the number of new families that are being created. If we want to cut into that, you know, a desperate lack of homes we have and really build it up, we need about 1.5 million, even higher, new homes built every single year and put up for sale.
Just makes me think about the trade war we're going to get into with Canada if this thing sticks. A lot of the supplies that make homes come from Canada. If there's a 25% tariff coming in, the president said we've got all the lumber we'll ever need here in the United States. So I guess we could cut down trees in America. I'm not against cutting down trees. But it just seems to me like if you limit then the supply, the cost goes up for lumber. If you're going to cut off Canada, American producers can and will charge more. I wouldn't blame them if they did.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand the whole idea of let's just cut down all of our own trees first. I don't understand why we have, you know, this whole tariff war going on. I feel like there's some story that we haven't been told yet, John, about what the real strategy is here, because right now it feels a little bit like throwing darts against a board. I sure hope that there is, you know, a bigger, deeper strategy and that somebody tells us about it pretty soon. But
well, in the case of Canada, I get it. I agree with you. The problems with Mexico seem to be more apparent. In the case of Canada, the migrants and the fentanyl that come across the border account for less than 1% of what we get. Less than 1% of migrants move into this country from Canada, and less than 1% of the fentanyl does. So what are we doing again with Canada? I'm not clear on that either. Let's just go back to homeowners for a minute while we have just about a minute left. 46% of homeowners say they have struggled to accurately estimate the cost of repairs and improvements, and 6% say they don't budget for unexpected repairs or improvements. Your thought about that?
I think that everybody should prepare, you know, to spend about, you know, at least 5 to 10% of your home's value every single year on everything on that list that I read: utilities, maintenance, renovation, taxes, homeowner insurance, right? You know, they're just expenses that are going to come up. And, you know, if you've got a house worth $500,000, I don't necessarily think you're going to spend $25,000 a year. But I think over the lifespan that you live there, you know, if you start, you replace a roof while you're there, if you have to replace your hot water heater and you start, you know, with, you know, getting a new dishwasher every few years, you know, every 5 or 10 years, it just adds up. So remember that these numbers are kind of your average or typical, but they may fall in different categories as the years go on. Just plan for something, and then you won't be that surprised.
Reporting today from Elise Glink, the owner of ThinkLink Media and Best Money Moves. Click on thinklink.com, and we'll click on you next week, too. Thanks, Elise.
Hey, you're welcome, John.
On WGN, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Jim Dahlke joins us Mondays, the director of communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. And what do you know, NVIDIA is in our news. What's the story there, Jim?
Hey, John. Yeah, the state officials are pitching NVIDIA to join the emerging and growing quantum computing campus on the city's south side. Nothing is official and nothing is really any close to being done. But according to Crane, officials in Illinois are courting NVIDIA to join the cohort of companies here. IBM, of course, is really one of the anchor tenants that recently announced it's going to take part in this campus. There's a handful of other businesses, including DARPA at the government level, that are going to be here participating in this quantum campus. So it would be a major get, certainly, from a PR perspective, but also from a technological perspective as well, being able to provide their chips to the growing quantum computing businesses here in the state of Illinois, where we're really trying to ramp up growth mm-hmm. in quantum computing. We're not the only state competing for quantum computing power and technology and researchers, which is a relatively small but yet growing group of professionals. So we're competing with places like Colorado and Maryland. So it would be a big gift for Illinois if NVIDIA did indeed operate space out at the Southside campus.
Well, are they looking for a space per se, or are we just courting them because it'd be swell to have them?
You know, I think it's a little bit of the latter. However, NVIDIA does have an increasing focus on quantum computing technology. It's got, you know, it's planning to hold its first quantum day during its annual artificial intelligence conference. Although the CEO, Jensen Huang, said that, you know, it's at CES recently that a useful quantum computer wasn't likely to emerge for about 20 years. So we're certainly playing the long game here with quantum computing, but landing a tenant like NVIDIA certainly would be a big deal for the state of Illinois.
Do you think the DeepSeek thing is going to impact their operations, their expansion, their investments?
You know, I don't think so. I think we maybe got a little over ahead of ourselves with the DeepSeek news. We'll kind of let that play out. The tech press does love to get you know, in a tizzy about stuff like that. But listen, here's what I'll say. You know, that news is potentially impactful for the artificial intelligence community, certainly on the early stage side, in that it might be cheaper to get into an AI future than we originally thought, right? DeepSeek was able to provide sort of models that were comparable to OpenAI for, you know, reportedly pennies on the dollar. And so, you know, we'll see, you know, how that business is able to continue to, you know, compete against some of the larger, well-funded behemoths in the AI space. But, you know, if their technology is as good as they say it is at the price that it is, that could just lower the cost of entry for AI competition really across the board.
It's interesting because the source code is open to the public. They're letting everybody see how they did it. You can use it. You can adapt it. You can change it. It's out there for anybody that wants to use it, which would seem like a good thing. That it's a Chinese company is another matter, though, isn't it? If we don't like TikTok because it's China, I wonder if we're going to look askance at this other AI company.
That's certainly part of it, right? And we need to kind of evaluate with a bit of skepticism, the price point that they're even mentioning that it costs to run this, right? So it's like there's a lot, I think, that we have to look at with a bit of a skeptical eye. But certainly, DeepSeek really, put a jolt into the artificial intelligence community the other week as we realized that, some of our competitors are putting some really impressive technology together at a fraction of the cost.
You also talked about this initiative over in Hyde Park. What's that all about?
Yeah, this is a new $130 million initiative over the next 10 years to help fund medical research out of the University of Chicago to turn successful drugs and other treatments into commercialized businesses. And so the investor here is Deerfield Management. They're going to invest that $130 million over 10 years. And really the goal is to build, medical technology businesses out of the University of Chicago, take the research that's being done and create startups. The interesting thing here is the level of funding that they provide, right? So Deerfield is funding these startups really in this kind of middle ground. So it's for research that's too later stage for kind of government funding. So think like the NHS. So they're further along than that, but not quite far enough along for traditional venture capital. So, they haven't really gotten far enough to where a traditional VC firm is going to come in and make an investment. So that's really the sweet spot for, what this funding is going to go to. So the hope here is that we're going to be able to take really a lot of the great research that's being done at the University of Chicago, give it some needed capital, and help turn this research into viable businesses.
You also pointed a story to our attention about hard tech. What is hard tech and what's the story there?
Yeah, hard tech is a physical product. So technology that's not software, doesn't live inside the computer. This is technology that is physical in nature. And it's certainly, from a funding standpoint and from a production standpoint, much more complicated than producing software. And MHUB is the local tech innovation hub here in Chicago that's really all about hard tech. And they just landed a $450,000 grant funding from two tech powerhouses, Salesforce and Google.org. That's the Google's philanthropic arm. They're going to be contributing here to MHUB to really give it some necessary resources to help continue to fund Chicago's hard tech innovators. Like I said, this is businesses that are harder to get funding for. They're harder to build. They need a lot of different resources. They need lab space. They need prototyping space. Yeah. They need CNC machines, 3D printing. And so there's a lot more that comes with that. This is some needed funding that's going to go right into the hands of Chicago's hard tech entrepreneurs.
Climate tech entrepreneurs.
Yeah, climate's a big piece of that as well, right? But, whether it's solar, wind, there's lots of opportunities for, folks in the hard tech space to be building towards, climate solutions as well. And so that's going to be a big piece of it.
Do you suppose that if the federal government's less interested in that, the private sector will pick up the slack, or are they going to lose interest because there ain't going to be other dollars coming in? There's not going to be the support one would imagine for the next 4 years.
Yeah, I definitely think there's an opportunity for the private sector to come in and maybe potentially fill a gap. We at TechNexus Venture Collaborative, we are big investors in electrification and clean energy as well. And our view on this is that we look at these investments far beyond 4 year cycles, right? So whatever happens during kind of this administration is not going to necessarily impact the way we think about the long term potential of climate innovations and green tech and electrification. And so I think that's how, other businesses are thinking about this as well. And certainly, from a funding standpoint, there's an opportunity for, the private sector to come in here and potentially fill a gap if the government's not going to do so.
Yeah, no kidding. It just seems to me like even if you want to either preserve some jobs or protect some industries, it doesn't have to come at the expense of these other emerging areas. The rest of the world is going green. And by that, I mean, they're interested in electric cars. They're interested in alternative sources of power. And whatever the politics are of the day in America doesn't change the fact that the planet is interested in those technologies. I can't imagine we would want to be behind on that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, Salesforce, for example, is going to be, using this funding to help MHUB create a brand new cohort called Energy Founders. This is a 6-month program that's going to help energy startups right here in Chicago with their hard tech innovation. So it's going to give them non-dilutive capital, access to lab space, additional fabrication resources. So that's a perfect example of the private sector coming right in here and saying, hey, we're going to help these climate founders, these energy founders, with a brand new program.
Jim Dahlke is the Director of Communications over TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Let's talk next week. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, John.
Let's get you more business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's CBOE Global Market says trading on its equities exchange will expand to 24 hours on weekdays. The move comes amid growing demand for U.S. stocks. Trading on the CBOE EDGX Equities Exchange will move to 24 hours after regulatory approval and cover Sunday night through Friday night. It'll not operate on the weekends. CBOE already allows some after-hours trading, and according to Bloomberg, average daily trading volume increased 135% between 2022 and 2024. United Airlines says there are no plans or current talks about merging or partnering with other airlines. Cranes reports the United statement follows a report that it was pursuing some sort of deal with JetBlue. The Chicago-based carrier says it's happy on the road it's currently on and pointed to strong results and a 2025 outlook. The merger speculation started when JetBlue execs were asked about partnerships with other airlines. They told reporters they were having talks with a number of other carriers. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. Let's see who's on the phone.
My name is Jamal Johnson.
And Jamal and his business partners, two of his University of Illinois college buddies from 30 years ago, share a passion.
A love for beer.
And they're doing something that very few black people do, which he will tell us about after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Okay, Jamal Johnson and his two college buddies decided to do what few black people had done. They started a brewery.
Less than 1% of all of the beer industry is African-American owned, so we wanted to create a brand-forward approach to the craft beer space.
But
we wanted to approach the beer industry a little different. I mean, obviously, there's some barriers to entry into the space for African Americans. One is access to capital.
So instead of sinking money into their own brick and mortar brew pub, they focused on making beer. And instead of building their own brewery, they had the Moores brand beer brewed by contract breweries. And it worked. Moores, spelled M-O-O-R-S, beers are very popular.
So now we feel like we're in a great position to have a space.
And that space is called Diversity House, and it opens this week.
2525, so February 5th, 2025.
It is a partnership between Moores Brewing and Steep Ravine Brewing, which used to be known as Ravinia Brewing before the festival sued for trademark infringement. It's near Logan Square.
2601 West Diversity.
And among the beers being featured is a tribute to Patsy Young, an enslaved woman who, after being freed in 1808, made her living brewing beer.
One of the very few African-American women to do so.
So, to honor Patsy Young and Black History Month,
we're starting a series of beers that's going to be exclusive to Diversity House called Patsy.
Besides beer, Diversity House will have what Jamal calls an elevated dining experience with three-time Chopped champion Mark Anthony Bynum running the kitchen. It opens 2525 Thursday at 2601 Diversity, just off the Kennedy. On the food calendar, it's National Carrot Cake Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Linda McGill-Bozeman is here to tell us about a business that employs 50 people, $50 million in budget, 60 million pounds of product delivered. And it's notable that McGill-Bozeman is the only African-American woman to run a chemical company in the United States, if I understand that correctly. Linda, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Pretty good. What should I know about your business?
Oh, I always tell people that you probably have on some of my chemicals.
Yeah, I noticed that. So it's all sorts of consumable but industrial things too. So you guys process chemicals for other companies like Palmolive or whomever. But tell me some of the products that you all help get to market that maybe I've come into contact with.
So I can tell you who a few of our clients would be. They could range anywhere from a Boeing to a Cisco to a Unilever, Clorox. There are many of the consumer brands and even private brands that private label brands that are out in the market today that contain our products. We like to say we make chemicals for everyday life.
So the raw materials come into Back of the Yards where you are located, and then what happens there?
So we purchase our raw materials, and then we react them. We do many types of chemical reactions, anywhere from esterification, condensation, neutralization. I know I'm talking a lot of chemical words, but
well, that's okay. You're a chemist, so I'll allow that.
Those are the types of things that we do, and I think our team is pretty proud of it.
How's business for you guys? How are things going?
Things are going well. I always, you know, when you're talking about a lot of your business and personal care, household and industrial, these are products and items that people utilize in their everyday life. And they think they're the types of chemicals and chemistries that are just used by, as I said, everyone every day. We also sell into other markets. We sell into pharmaceutical. We sell into metalworking. And so we also sell into markets that are not used in those types of manners.
You haven't mentioned anything by brand name. Is it because you can't, or can you tell me? Is it Prell? Is it?
I can only tell you the company. I can't specify their brand. Unfortunately, you're right.
That's interesting. And then, how do you go about attracting? How do you get business? I guess it's B2B. You go to trade shows. You develop relationships. That sort of thing.
This is a very, very much a relationship-driven business. As a matter of fact, I am just at a trade show right now. And we have another one coming up where we will take some of our R&D personnel, and these go throughout the year. I think our next one is up in May. But this is how we go to market. Since it is B2B, it's a long process. So once you get your chemicals qualified, typically you're with your client for quite some time.
Is it, you know, I mentioned that as a black woman, you're unique in the field. Comment on that a little bit. Is that advantageous to you in some ways? Does it make it more difficult to do what you do?
Actually, I think it makes it more difficult to do what I do. It is still a very male-driven industry. As I said, I just came from a show. Typically, I'm the only me in the room, or unless I bring someone else from our company. Means that I have to go what I always call a validation process.
Yeah.
Since we've been in business for quite a while now, our name is out there in the B2B market. And so what we have seen over the last 10 years, some significant growth due to the fact that, okay, you know, we're out here. We've proven that we can deliver tens of millions of pounds of products to these clients.
Do you have any concerns about tariffs with other nations? Will that affect what you do positively or negatively?
I actually was the past president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and that has a lot of manufacturers in Illinois, not just like Cedar Concepts, but you'll have like the ADMs of the world, the John Deere's, quite a few large corporations. I think we're all in a wait-and-see mode. I think they're going to still have to digest how all of the things that come into the country are connected. And I don't know that task is yet to be done. And I think that's why we see some, let's do this, and you see the pullback. Because you think, it's just using this one market, but you don't understand that that's a raw material for something else. And, you know, this sort of catapults to another market. And so I think there's still a little bit of homework to be done on that. And from what I've heard coming from the conference I just attended, everyone is pretty much in a wait-and-see mode. We're just in a holding pattern.
You didn't say everybody's panicking.
No, I don't think we're going to. It doesn't pay to panic, right? All you can do is hopefully react in a positive manner. But no, I don't. We're not in panic mode yet.
Linda McGill-Bozeman is the owner and president of Cedar Concepts. You can find out more at cedarconcepts.net. Really interesting to meet you, Linda. Thank you for your time today.
And thank you.